she stood up in Bush's front lawn and really was making a difference for us. At the time, I was at home with two little babies and was in no condition to be out marching, but I was supporting her in my heart. I really believe in the work that she's doing. She became an anti-war activist, as you may recall, after her son, Casey, a soldier in Iraq, was killed. I have shared an experience with her in that I have lost a son, but he was stillborn after 9 months of pregnancy. And I never got a chance to raise that boy as she did her Casey. So I feel so, words can't express exactly how strongly I feel about what that loss must be to her. I can only imagine having my own son who's about to be 21 and considering going into the service. Now sometimes called Rosa Parks of the anti-war movement. She's going to talk to us about the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, boy, this is a lot, Pakistan, Libya, Somalia, and, now as if she's not done enough, bailouts for banks and the corporate elite, and about cutbacks for us, and economic recession, which our family has a firsthand experience with. My husband's a music teacher, his program was recently cut, and about money only for wars, not jobs. She has much to tell us about working for wars for corporate profit and standing together as a team, because together, everyone achieves more for understanding peace and better lives for all of us. Give it a big hand for Justice Studies Department is supporting us today. The Sociology Club put up a Facebook event page, and I want to thank the 9 people who agreed to come. And the Muslim Student Association is helping us with the food afterwards. We got food by Merla's Kitchen. It's a lovely little family-owned Filipino restaurant around the corner from the university. If you've never been there, you'll have a chance to savor some of their delicacies today.
Thank you. I'd also like to thank Kathleen and Loretta and the students here on campus for supporting my visit here. But also I'd like to thank Stan Smith from the Cuban Five Committee here in Chicago, because he actually is the one who invited me to this area and made the connections with all the campuses that I'm speaking at. So a big thank you to Stan Smith. A Chicago area super activist. And he's standing next to my friend Lobo, who plays a cop on TV. Just kidding, he works at your campus, but on the south side, right? And he is one of my good Camp Casey friends. He came down to Crawford, Texas every time we went down there. And we actually went many times, not just the first summer. From like 2005 until 2007, every time George Bush went, we went. Because we made him that promise. Every time he was on vacation, we were going to go to Texas too. And until he met with me and answered my question. And he never did. And so I've harassed him in Crawford. I've harassed him in Washington, D.C. I've harassed him now in Dallas, where he now lives. Because he still hasn't answered my question. My question was, what noble cause? And there's... Sorry, pardon me? Oh, because he said so. Yeah, I never even accepted that from my parents. They'd say, because I said so. I'd say, well, then who are you? Believe it or not. So anyway, I also think Mark, that was amazing. Mark, his guitar playing. I hope he'll trade a book for my CD. Wait, I hope he'll trade his CD for my book. I don't make CDs for obvious reasons. But I do have also a book out there for sale. It's called Not One More Mother's Child. It's $10. It's my articles I wrote before I went to Crawford, Texas in the summer of 2005. I wrote an article every day I was there, and for some shortly after. So it's my first book. I have 5 books now. And it has pictures. It has good pictures in it, too. So if anybody wants to buy this, I'd be happy to autograph it for them. I'm also going to pass around an emailing list. I have a show called Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. It's a radio show. It's on my website. And I send out emails about who's going to be on my show this week. I send out articles that I think are important and relevant to the subject. I have all my subjects on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox revolve around social justice issues, peace issues. I've had some amazing guests in the peace and justice world. I've had some so-called celebrities on. Yoko Ono was on my show before. Yoko Ono Lennon, for you young people, she was married to John Lennon. There was a group called the Beatles before you were born. They were kind of big. And she was married to John Lennon. She was accused of breaking up the Beatles. That's pretty badass. And I've had people advocating for legalization of marijuana, like Tommy Chong from Cheech and Chong. So I find important subjects, and I try to get the most articulate guests on. And then I also write my own blog full of articles and what I think is relevant information that I pass along. So I'm going to pass this list around. If you would like to be on my emailing list, then sign up for it. I also wrote a book that's just a PDF. And I used to say it's a PDF file, but I think the F stands for file. I'm not sure what the PD stands for, but I know the F, so PDF file is redundant. So I have a PDF book. It's called Myth America, The 20 Greatest Myths of the Robber Class and the Case for Revolution. Do you get it, Myth America? Myth, it's like Miss America, only it's like I have a lisp. So, are you guys awake? Is this thing on? Hello? Are you guys out there? Hello? So anyway, I wrote it in 2009. I toured the country. I went to about 60 cities talking about my book. And now, if somebody signs up for my email list, I automatically email you a copy of it. So you can do whatever. You can download it. You can pass it to anybody you want to pass it to. It's totally a free offering. So that's I call it my womanifesto, not manifesto, but womanifesto, Myth America. So anybody here from women's studies? Yeah. So I have a lot to talk about. I better get started. I didn't know. We always like to have a subject So we always have a subject for my talks and what I'm going to talk about, but I basically just start talking and we see where it goes to from there. But I think there's a real relevant issue, a real profound problem happening in the United States. And it's the widening gap between the rich and the poor. You might not know this. Everybody's always like, we have these nationalists that are always like, USA's number one, USA's number one. There's very few things we're number one in. We're number one in militarism. We're number one in defense spending. We're not number one in education. I don't even know what number we are in education. It's somewhere in the high teens. We're number 39 in healthcare. People are always saying, oh, we have the best healthcare system in the world. We do if you're rich. If you're rich, it's an awesome healthcare system. But it's number 39 in the world. There's one myth I write about called the United States is the best country in the universe. I don't say in history. I don't say on the planet. I say in the universe to make an illustration. Okay, many people say, oh, we're the best nation in history. We're the best nation in on the planet or whatever. But I know that if there is another country on another planet in another solar system, that we are better than it. We already know we're better than that country. We don't have to know anything about that country's history. We don't need to know anything about that country's culture. We don't need to know anything about their religion, their politics. We already know we're better than that. And I make an illustration. Which way is north? From here, from where I'm standing. Is north that way? Okay. I only know my directions when I'm at home. Because I know where the freeways are. And so, in Canada, many people in here in the United States, Canada's very close to here, I understand. Because when I was in school, we used to teach geography. Canada, many people in the United States tell me Canadians hate their healthcare system. I've never met a Canadian that hates their healthcare system. I go to Canada a lot. I look for these people. Do you hate your healthcare system? No, we love it. We'd have a revolution if they tried to take it away from us. And Canadians, they're the ones who apologize to you if you step on their toe. Right? They're very polite. They're very non-revolutionaries. But they would go up in arms if they tried to have their healthcare system taken away from them. So, there's another country in our continent. If that's north, that must be south, right? Am I right? Mexico. Mexico. People tell me that it's the dream of the Mexican people to leave Mexico, go north, and steal all of our good dishwashing and lettuce picking jobs. You know, it's their dream to immigrate to the United States. No, it's not. You know what the dream is of people from Mexico or in Mexico that I talk to? They have a movement that they want to stay. They want to work in their own country. They have family there. They have history there. They have community there. They don't want to come up to the United States and steal our good dishwashing jobs. They want to have good, paying, meaningful jobs in Mexico. And what prevents them from that? Globalization, free trade agreements. Do you know in the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, it requires Mexico to buy corn from the United States? They grow corn in Mexico. They used to grow corn in Mexico. These free trade agreements have taken the lands of the workers in Mexico and given the lands to American big, what do they call those? Corporate farming. So they can't use the seed that they've been using for generations. They have to use genetically modified organisms, they call it. Genetically modified seed. They're required through the free trade agreement. So we don't even know anything about the countries we know very little about the countries to the north and the south of us. You know, our national identity is so strongly based on mythology that we are easily manipulated through propaganda media, through the manipulations of the political system, even through our schools. You know, from the time we're born, we get these myths put on us. One myth that I was taught, I was born born in 1957, back in Happy Days, right? Right, did you guys ever see Happy Days? Because I know you weren't born back then, you didn't live back then. But some of you did, I can tell. Not all of you. But there was the communist scare. Now it's the terrorist scare, right? Back in the 50s, it was a communist scare. And in the early 60s. And there was witch hunts. Congress hunted out people that they were accused of. First of all, being a communist isn't against the law. You know, it's a right protected by the United States Constitution to freely affiliate with, you know, religious affiliation, political affiliation. First of all, it was never against the law to be a communist. And so they had these witch hunts, and there was this Red Scare. Do you remember if you were from those days? You never said communist without saying red in front of it. Or you never said Chinese or China without saying Red China. Red Soviet Union. Red communist, whatever. And so when I was in second grade, I was 7 years old. My teacher, Miss McMurray, in what I now realize was child abuse, she asked the class, if a red communist came up to you and stuck a gun to your head and told you not to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, what would you do? And so I was a very shy child. I was a shy person, believe it or not. But I knew the answer to this one. I was so sure of it, I raised my hand. I could tell Miss McMurray was surprised that I was volunteering an answer. So she called on me. She said, Cindy Miller. There was two Cindys in my class. That was a real popular name back then, too. Cindy, Karen, and Debbie. And so how many Debbies do we have here? I'm really surprised. And so anyway, I said, I wouldn't say it. And she goes, wrong! And she sent me to the corner. She called me anti-American and sent me to the corner. And I'm in the corner going, I don't care, I still wouldn't say it. You know, I don't want my head blown off. That's stupid. But that's child abuse, right? And so already I was afraid of the Holy Ghost. Now, that's what they used to call the Holy Spirit back in the day. So I'm like, ghost, that's scary. And now I had to be afraid of a red communist coming up to me and holding a gun in my head and telling me not recite the Pledge of Allegiance or he'd blow my head off. And I still would say no. Okay, I won't. I don't get my head blown off. That's fine. That's cool with me. And so anyway, also, when we were young, you guys might remember that at a certain point in time during the week, an air raid siren went off, and we had to go under our desks. Because the air raid siren was in case of a nuclear attack. And so by the time I was in fifth grade, we'd be under our desks, and we'd be talking to each other. And we'd be, are these desks, do they have some kind of magical properties? That if there's some kind of nuclear attack, that our magical desks are going to protect us and we're going to be fine and everything like that. So did any of you have to do that? Yeah. You know, we had to do it up until I think I was like in fifth or sixth grade. Every Friday at 2:00. You know, so we were conditioned that even before the siren, we'd just go under our desks because we knew when it was coming up. And so anyway, I talked about the problem, about the widening gap between the rich and the poor here in the United States. Guess what? Recently, it's been reported that the United States has the widest gap between the rich and the poor of any other industrialized nation. And yet, I travel all over the world. Still, we have an apparent high standard of living because a lot of us own things. But the things we own are usually bought on credit, so we don't really own them. So we're encouraged to become these debt slaves, so we must also then be wage slaves. And the wages are being depressed because if you have an unemployment rate that's really around 20%, you know, they say it's like 9-point-something%, which is bad enough. But during the Clinton administration, they stopped counting the people who went off of unemployment because they were unemployed for the length of time that they're eligible. So they stopped counting those people. Before Clinton, they counted the people who were underemployed, who were just working part-time. So those people aren't counted either. And so if you stop looking for work, if you're not on unemployment, if you're working just a part-time job at minimum wage, you're not counted in the unemployment figures like they used to be. And so people who are economists, they figure out the real unemployment rate. And the real unemployment rate is hovering around 20%. In the Great Depression, it was 25% during the Great Depression. And so if there's an unemployment rate of 20%, well, guess what? That lowers the power of the workers. Because, you know, we can't organize and say, let's General Electric, the CEO makes millions of dollars. General Electric had a profit of $11 billion in 2010. Does anybody know how much in taxes General Electric paid to the United States of America?
Zero.
Zero. As a matter of fact, they got a refund. They got a refund. And so we can go, oh, let's organize. Let's stick together and let's strike for better pay, for better working conditions. And what do the employers say? For every one of you, there's 100 people that want your job. Go. I can hire them. They'll work for less. So our bargaining power, while the corporation's profits are going up, our wages are going down, and our collective power is going down. And people say, well, what does this have to do with war and peace? Why does a peace activist, why does an anti-war activist care about the economy? Well, in 2005, I was writing that if the U.S. didn't end these wars of aggression in the Middle East, our economy would collapse. Nobel Economy Prize winners. What, does that make sense? They won the Nobel Prize for economics. They have estimated, and they estimated this back then, that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan cost our economy $3 trillion. Some people have estimated, because we don't know for sure, that the bailouts of Wall Street and the banks have cost our economy $12 trillion. Yet, tuition keeps going up. Yet, the cost of health care keeps going up. The cost of food keeps going up because the cost of gas keeps going up. Prices are going up and wages are going down. And 2% of the wealthy in this country own at least 96% of the wealth. But we don't, in the United States, we don't resent that. Why don't we resent that? I resent that. I resent that I have to a script to pay my rent every month, and I'm not lazy. I'm a hard worker. You know, so many people on the right would want to say, well, if you don't have a job, then you must be lazy. Not recognizing that we have a systemic failure in this country. It's not about the individual, it's about the systemic failure. I resent it. I resent that the Clintons can have a wedding for their daughter and it costs $1,500 a plate for the food. I can pay almost 4 months' rent with that money. I resent that her wedding cake costs $26,000. I could buy a condo in my complex for $26,000. Do you resent it or do you worship it? That's the problem in our country. We worship these people. And I want to tell you, not all, but most people who have that kind of wealth have done it through corruption, have done it through stealing from us. They stole from us, and many of the wealthy in this nation stole from our mothers, our fathers, our grandmothers, our grandfathers, and they did it by either directly stealing land or exploiting the labor. And what does that even have to do with war and peace? Well, in an economy where there's 20% unemployment and where university is inaccessible to many, many people, I told a story earlier in a class I spoke in, Loretta Capehart, social justice class. I went back to school in the 1990s. Wait, yeah, well, it doesn't matter. Well, it kind of does. I have to put this in context. It was the beginning of the 90s. I went to UCLA. Good school, go Bruins. And it was $600 per quarter. I thought that was a lot, $600 per quarter. I tried to go back to UCLA. I reapplied. They accepted me. It's $4,500 a quarter now. It's like, oh, I guess I'm not going back to school. And my daughter just got her master's degree. She owes $50,000 in student loans. And that's not bad, by the way. She got a lot of scholarships. She got a lot of grants. She got a lot of help. So $50,000 for a master's degree. We have a friend who's going somewhere close to here, Butler, right? That's a school, right? She might be going to Butler. She might be going somewhere else. Let's just say Butler. I might be speaking there next month. I don't know. We'll just make up that it's Butler. She's getting her doctorate. She's going to have $800,000 in student loans. My daughter went to public schools. That's why her loans are so small. She got her master's degree. The month she didn't sign up for school, they took $500 out of her checking account. And she'll have to pay $500 probably a month for the rest of her life. How is that right? Education, I believe, and trust me, I'm not the only one in the world, maybe not the only one in this auditorium that believes this. Education is a human right. It's not a privilege. It's not a privilege for the wealthy. Healthcare is a human right. It's not a privilege for the wealthy. But if we go to our government and we say, some people have class, or they're mad, I don't know. If we go to our government and we say, you know, we really think that education is a human right, and we think that education should be free from preschool to university, what does our government always tell us? There's no money for that. If we go and we tell, and we have proven, we have something called statistics. that show that a single-payer Medicare for All healthcare system would be cheaper than the one we have now, and it would be universal, 100% of the people would be covered, and it would create jobs. We actually have those things, numbers, to show that. They say we don't have money for that. But if Goldman Sachs, this scandalous Wall Street company, says the industry needs $850 billion for a bailout, what does the government say? Well, you want cash or check? You know, why is there money to bail out the wealthy and to help them when there's no money for us and our needs? They're saying there's... What did Gandhi say? There's something about human greed and human needs. There's not enough for human greed, but there's plenty for human need. And the thing about the wealthy, and when I say I resent their opulent lifestyles, I don't resent a comfortable lifestyle. I think we all deserve a comfortable lifestyle. And when people say, I want to be like the rich, I say, I don't want to be like the rich. I want the rich to be like us. I want a more equitable distribution of the wealth. And if that occurred, and our children felt that they had guaranteed health care, guaranteed education, then they wouldn't feel such a need to join the military. My son, Casey, was 21 years old. He had already done everything he could do at a community college. In California, community colleges are far less expensive than state universities or UCs. And he had gotten all his credits there he could get. He had his associate's in arts degree in drama. And he was hoping to go to university. But we have always been a working class family. He was the oldest of four. And sometimes I worked three jobs just so we could have health care, so we could provide our family health care. And so anyway, Casey didn't want to further strain the family finances, but he wanted to go to university. So he joined the military. You know, he didn't join the military because he felt like, and he joined before 9/11, it was no like, I want to go and avenge that we were attacked, blah, blah, blah. He joined for economic reasons. And many, many, many people do. There was a man who lives in the Midwest somewhere. He's 44 years old. He lost his job, and his wife had cancer. And so they lost their insurance. So what did he do? He re-enlisted in the military so his wife could get health insurance because she had cancer. What kind of society is this that we live in? I've talked to young people who join the military because they need to get their teeth fixed. What kind of society do we live in where you have to choose between going in the military and getting a college education? Choose between getting your teeth fixed or going in the military. That's just inherently unjust. If you want to talk about social justice, that's not. If you want to join the military, for whatever reason you have, it shouldn't be because you feel, because of economic circumstances, that you're forced to join the military. Does anybody agree with that? Okay, that's good. And the justice issue on that is that there are many people in this country who profit from war. Their economy is doing fine. Their economy is doing great. The politicians who send our children to war, you know, some of the biggest donors to their campaigns are from military contractors and war profiteers. And the banks who get to create money to pay for these wars, profit from war. But you know what? Their children don't fight the wars. Their children don't have to. Their children can go to college and have their college paid for. Their children have the best health care on the, and they have the straightest teeth on the planet. That's not justice. That's a situation. What I call the robber class in this country. You know, some people call them the oligarchy. Some people call them the plutocracy. Some people call them the ruling class. But they don't rule over me, so I won't call them the ruling class. The robber class, they know, they're the ones that know that the only relevant division in this society is a class division. You know, here down in our class, that I call, if there's a robber class, there must be a robbed class. So I call what we live in the robbed class. You know, we pick these petty fights with each other over what the robber class calls wedge issues. And that's what they're intended to drive a wedge between us. And these are important issues for sure. I mean, I'm on the side of, you know, marriage equality, pro-choice. You know, education is a right, healthcare is a right. I'm on all those sides. And down in the robbed class, we do have ideological differences on that. But while we're fighting these battles with each other, the robber class is robbing us blind. And one of my favorite signs ever at a protest says, "They only call it a class war when we fight back." Right? And until then, until we fight back, it's just business as usual for the robber class. And I just hate to tell you that George Bush and Dick Cheney didn't invent this. It was going on long before George Bush and Dick Cheney came into office in 2000. They made it more obvious, for sure, right? I mean, stealing elections, lying about wars. I mean, they were just very torture, admitting to torture, saying it's great, saying it's wonderful, kept us safe, blah, 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 whatever, selling their books. You know, they did make it more obvious, and that's why they had to go. That's why we needed a kinder, gentler face on the empire. And so, from the moment this country started, you know, it's founded on black slavery. It's founded on genocide of our indigenous population. The Constitution, the document, our founding documents, were racist and sexist and elitist. We can't do anything. If we don't like the Constitution, we have to wait till the robber class decides that they want to amend it. And then it'll get amended. But the positive thing about what's happening in our country today is that people, I believe, and I see it, I travel all over, are starting to wake up in a big way. Before, they didn't think about the wars for empire, the wars of aggression. It didn't affect them. When they thought it didn't affect them, but everybody in this country is profoundly affected by these wars of aggression, wars for empire. Just when you go to the pump and have to pay $4.09 a gallon. If we're going to these wars and owning all the oil in the world, why has gas risen? You know, when Obama took office, gas was $1.75 a gallon. Now we're in Libya. Libya has the sweet crude oil, they call it, easily pumped out, easily refined. Why are we paying so much for gas? Just those little things. And the high cost of fuel causes a high cost of consumer goods. So everybody has lost from these wars of aggression. Everybody in this country is being, except for the robber class. When I say everybody, I'm talking about the important people. I'm talking about us. And not only that, but we have all, by the policies of our government, torture, using weapons of mass destruction against innocent people. You know, war today is, the casualties are at least 95% civilian. Used to be just combatants. You know, and the weapons were very close. You had to be close to somebody if you were having wars. But progressively, more and the percentage of civilians being killed have been more and more and more. Torture as an institutional policy. Torture that is an international war crime and crime against humanity. But the Bush administration said it was okay to protect Americans. And you know what I say? If one person has to be protected, be tortured to protect me, I don't want protection. If one person has to be killed to protect, an innocent person has to be killed to protect me, I don't want that. Hillary Clinton, one of my nemesis, is that a word, nemesis? 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 She told the press, after I met with her, that we had to continue the wars to honor the sacrifice of my son. Well, if one person's honored killed to honor Casey's sacrifice, does that mean we have to kill one more person to honor that person's sacrifice? Then kill one more person to honor that person's sacrifice? On and on and on, a never-ending cycle? Well, if we don't stop that cycle, and if we don't rise up as a movement to force the robber class to change things, this empire will collapse. Yay, I'm glad, good. You know, there's never been an empire that didn't. And we have recent evidence of this when the Soviet Union collapsed after their decade-long war to try to subdue Afghanistan. Does Afghanistan sound familiar to anybody? We've been at war in that country for 10 years, sucking the resources, our young people, our money, down a hole. They just told us it costs $1 million per year, per troop, for them to stay in Afghanistan. $1 million per year per troop. Do any of you think that you could use $1 million to do something else besides occupy a country? So this path that we're on, this destructive path, it has to end. It's going to end one of two ways, voluntarily or involuntarily. So I'm just going to end with this and then take some questions. So we have about 10 minutes left. People, a lot of people email to me, very good-hearted people. They say, Cindy, you have to tell the president that the Soviet Union collapsed because of Afghanistan. You have to tell him to stop. And I always respond to them, first of all, have you ever known a president that listened to me? If there was a president that listened to me, things would be different. Secondly, Obama knows this. You know, Obama is not stupid. The people who surround Obama are not stupid. The government They know that the occupation or the quest for annexing Afghanistan to the Soviet Union made the Soviet Union collapse. So why don't you ask Obama your own question? Why? Why are you still doing it when you know this? So thank you for being here, and I'd love to answer some questions. And I do have solutions too. This one time, this one man stood up, he's like, Cindy, gosh, I listened to you and I agree with everything you say, but now I feel like killing myself. But there are solutions also that involve creating healthy systems outside of the disease systems that currently exist in our nation. Does anybody have a question? And if you signed up for my list, I'll send you my book, Myth America. The revolution part is a lot of very practical and doable suggestions that we can do to have a peaceful transition from this capitalist economy that we live in right now to one that is more egalitarian. No questions? Yes. She said that Tom Hartman has a book out that's about revolution also, and I just want to point out he wrote the foreword to this book. Well, not the foreword, but something. Cindy, a historic perspective, an historic perspective. So a lot of people are on this parallel path. Many activists and organizations, there's an organization called Transition. And it used to be Transition Towns, but it's more like transition communities now, transitioning from the carbon-based economy to a more healthy economy. There's many people who think that creating community and healthy systems in your community is a way to overthrow the system we have. And it's by doing it in a very grassroots, democratic way, taking over local city councils. Like in the 80s, where I lived in Southern California, many people on the fanatic religious right took over school boards. Started banning books and putting in these really religious curriculum in public schools. We could do that, but we could do it in a good way. You know, we could be on school boards, we could be on city councils, we could have intentional housing, intentional communities, where you have your co-op and you have your boards there. Growing our own food, I think, is essential. If you aren't producing part of your food, start doing it now. Even if you live in a dorm room. You know, you can still grow weed if you want, but, you know, none of you do that. That's against the law. Not me. I don't do that. People who are recording me. But anyway. I really don't, but anyway. You know, you can grow herbs, you can grow anything, but if you can't grow anything, then you have farmers markets. You need to purchase your food grown as close to you as possible. There's this great movie, a documentary, and I recommend it to everybody. It's called The Economics of Happiness, and it's about this localization. That globalization is ruining the world, localization will save the world. And she points out that in many commodities, and I'm just going to use milk in Great Britain. Great Britain exports the same amount of milk as it imports. That's just for the globalists. That's using fuel. That's wasting resources. The milk produced in Great Britain should stay in Great Britain. The milk produced wherever stays there. It's better for the environment, it's better for your health, believe me. It's better for everything if you consume whatever you consume grown as close to you as possible. It's not always possible, but most of the time it's possible. So another question? Back there.
What is it that
introduced you to? Well, my son was killed in Iraq in 2004. And I was always against the wars. I was always against George Bush. But I wasn't really plugged into any protest communities. I didn't know about protests until they already happened. And I also believed then one of the myths that one person can't make a difference. I thought, well, there was millions of people on February 15th, I think, in 2003, around the world saying, don't invade Iraq. What George Bush said, oh, we don't have to pay attention to focus groups. Millions of people are protesting the wars. He called them focus groups. And so after my son was killed, you know, I thought, first of all, I felt very, very guilty that I didn't protest. I told him, he knew my feelings. He felt the same way. He didn't want to go, but he said, you know, the sooner I go, the sooner I'll come home. I have to go, you know, or I have to go to prison or whatever. And so after Casey was killed in a war based on lies that I didn't agree with, never agreed with, you know, I thought the pain was so intense that I would like to prevent other people from feeling that, having to feel that pain. So I just started investigating. I joined a few anti-war organizations. But then in 2007, I'm trying to give the Reader's Digest version. I have many other books. One of them is Peace Moms, more of a narrative of my story. In 2005, the Democrats told me, if you help us get majority of the House, we'll help you end the wars. And I was like, well, that sounds like a good deal. So I helped them. They got a majority. They didn't end the wars. They voted to approve George Bush's surge in Iraq. They voted to give George Bush more money for the wars. I went back to D.C. I went back to all these people. I said, hey, what gives? You told me this. You're not doing that. I complied. I helped you. Now you're not ending the wars. What's wrong? They told me, Cindy, we need more Democrats. And I was just like, forget it. You know, I was born during the day, but I wasn't born yesterday. And I obviously the solution isn't in the two-party system. It's outside of the system. So then I started to realize that the problem wasn't George Bush. He is a problem, but not the problem. The problem wasn't the Iraq War. It's a problem, not the problem. The problem is deeply systemic. And if we just keep on going and throwing all our energy at just part of the problem, it's never going to be solved. How many people here protested the Vietnam War? So the Vietnam War ended, but did war end? Because it was an anti-war movement. You know, the movements can, once in a while, you know, so many people take credit for ending the Vietnam War. It was the vets, it was the students, it was Congress, it was the anti-war movement. What it really was the Vietnamese resistance that ended that war. they need to actually get the most credit for ending the war. They beat the crap out of the United States. But anyway, it's another thing. I'm accused of not liking veterans. It's actually the country that doesn't like veterans. You know, 50% of our homeless people are veterans. They have a hard time accessing health care. There are student benefits. The more wars we have, it seems like there's less money to reintegrate our veterans. And even if there was money, there's no jobs. You know, what are they going to come home and find a job doing that's good pay, that pays a living wage and is meaningful work? That's hard for anybody to find. So So I started connecting the dots to answer your question. You know, Henry David Thoreau is one of my heroes. And he said, for every 1,000 people hacking at the branches of the problem, there's one attacking the root. And so every 1,000 that are there hacking at the branches, there's one that's getting to the root of the problem. We need to reverse that. We need, for every one person who's attacking the branches, we need 1,000 people fighting the root of the problem. So we might have time for one more question if I have a short answer. My answers are really long. You had your hand up. I don't like to speculate. You know, so many people say, well, Obama's bad, but McCain would be worse. How do they know that? You know, what we can't speculate about that because we have so many problems right now we have to address. So the one thing I know about Al Gore is that in 2000, when millions of people wanted to fight for the right to have their vote counted, he capitulated. That's the one thing I know for sure about Al Gore. We were sending money to his campaign to fight. And people still wanted to fight. People on his staff wanted to fight. But he said, no, we have to stop. And that's the one thing that I know. He prevented millions of people from having their vote counted. And you know, in our system, that's not supposed to be. That's not supposed to happen. When he gave up, he prevented us from having our vote counted. You know, there was no reason to stop the count. There was no reason to do that. He should have fought until every damn last vote was counted. And maybe we wouldn't have had George Bush. But my point is, it's a systemic problem. And even if we think that Obama is the answer, many people tell me Ron Paul is the answer. They're not the answers. You sitting there, you're the answer. You're everybody in here, we're the answers. And you know what? It's so much easier to go and say, I voted for you, go to DC, have fun, ruin the country, and I'll just do my thing. No. And that's what they want us to believe. They constantly tell us change happens at the voting booth. What change? Good change? There's such a thing as bad change too. So that's our very smallest part in humanity is voting. The real work happens between elections. And it doesn't, I think putting our energies into presidential politics is wasteful. We need to put our energies locally. We need to believe in ourselves and believe in each other. And that's when I believe true change will really happen. But our time's up. I'll be out in the back if you want to buy a book or say hi or whatever. I'm going to go, I don't know if it's the back or the front. Back there.
Front there.